Welcome to the Creativity Cafe, where we get to explore creativity in all its aspects, from designing your lifestyle, your work and business, to creating more beautiful and sustainable solutions to global challenges. I'm Katie Curtin, and I'm hosting this cafe along with Denise Rushing. We're both passionate about creativity and making a difference in this time of planetary transformation. And today's guest is Clovis Lewis, who will be talking to us on the topic of the modern Renaissance artist and inventor, cultivating happiness, focus, and flow every day. And I'm so excited to welcome Clovis. He's a prize-winning composer and cellist. He's also enjoyed a dual and extensive career as a technologist and serial entrepreneur, and he started his first consulting business, Technology Media Enterprises, in March of 1984. And this company was in the forefront of desktop publishing, computer graphics, and multimedia productions. And since then, Clovis has created multiple businesses. His most recent love is providing his music to the world for free at jazzicalmusic.com. And he's also an inventor, and this is very exciting too. And he's currently working in the area of solar and sustainable housing technology. We'll be spending about 40 to 45 minutes talking about today's topic, and then we'll open up for calls, up the call for questions and discussion from our audience. So I would like to welcome you all, and also Denise is here on the call with me to ask the questions, and make yourself comfortable, take a sip of your favorite brew while I welcome Clovis. Clovis, are you there?
I am indeed. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Denise. It's a pleasure to be with you today. This is an exciting topic, and it's something that is really, really close to my heart.
And close to both of ours. We may not have quite the same interests in common, but I'm definitely a Renaissance person, so I'm really excited to hear about how you deal with those challenges. And what I'm thinking, Clovis, first of all, would you tell us a bit about your journey, about how you got into being both a musician and a composer and then an inventor? Or maybe you were all these all along. So could you tell us more?
Well, you know, I actually think that I was all of the above all along from the time that I was born. You know, it's an interesting thing. And my father was in the Air Force when I was a child, up until the time that I was in high school, last year of high school. He was in for 20 years. And he came from a family of 11 kids. And nearly all of them are musicians.
Wow.
And so what happened, you know, I grew up listening to all kinds of music, and my father had a phenomenal voice that was like I described as a cross between Nat King Cole and Johnny Mathis, and so he was always singing and had bands as I was growing up, and I thought everybody's dad did things like that, right?
If only they did.
So I had cousins who played instruments, and in 1968, I was in seventh grade. We were living in Abilene, Texas, and we spent that summer of 1968 in Mobile, Alabama, with my grandmother and a bunch of my cousins, and they were playing instruments, and I said, well, I want to play instrument too. I wanted to play the bass. So I went back to Abilene, Texas. In the first day of eighth grade, I went to the string teacher at the junior high school, and I said, I want to play the bass. And he looked at me and he said, well, you're too small for the bass, but there's this little bass called the cello. And you can play that, and then when you get bigger, you can play the big bass. And I said, okay. And he said, he asked me something, and I said, yes. That's because most times when people talk to me in Texas, I didn't understand what they were saying. So he said something to me. I said yes, and he walked away. He said, "I'll be back in 10 minutes, and you can play a C major scale for me then." So there was this guy named Rodney Hitch who was practicing cello, and I said, "Dude, can you show me?" Well, I didn't say dude at that time, but that you, hey, can you show me how to play a C major scale on the cello? And so he did, and Mr. Bell came back 10 minutes later, and I played for him a C major scale, and he said, "Okay, you're in the orchestra."
Wow.
So, but the thing is that about as soon as I learned where the notes were on the cello, I was composing. So I was composing music about 3 weeks after I started learning the cello. And people find that really extraordinary. But to me, it was very simple. It was like, well, you read and write, so why is music any different? You know, you read and write books, and you write English, so it's always seemed to me. I always had music in my head, and I thought everybody did. So as soon as I learned that language and the symbology of where notes were, I was composing. And I composed before I even knew any theory. It's just I was putting music down and doing what made sense. And at the same time, something happened. I mean, I started playing the cello and I couldn't stop. And I was totally in love with music and playing an instrument that I could create from my what's in my head. And about 6 months after that, I was winning solo competitions in Texas. So it was like something woke up in me. It's like a switch was flipped, and it was like this creativity was just flowing out of me. And like I said, I always had music, and I always actually even had invention swimming in my head. And so in eighth grade, I found the tools to express them. Like I said, my father was in the Air Force, and a funny thing was that he used to bring top secret military manuals home, and he put them up in the closet, up high. And I came to see that my father's top secret manuals were there. And of course, I read them, right? You know, and I came to understand how the Strategic Air Command worked. I didn't understand it all, but I was really turned on by all the functional block diagrams and the pictures of airplanes, and, you know, because I absolutely love airplanes and later became a pilot. But and then when my father was we grew up sorting components, electronic components, with my father's Heathkit kits. So I grew up with electronics, and I grew up with my father teaching us about electricity and electronics. So when I went to college, I started combining electronic music with my compositions, and that was very natural. And then I needed to extend what I was doing electronically using computers. So I learned a Fortran language called Music 5 in college, and programming seemed really natural. It was just like a natural extension of composition to me. And then when I got out of college, I became a technical writer. I was still composing. And then at that same time, I became a professor at UC Santa Barbara. And I was teaching computer music and theory and composition and ear training and that sort of thing. And becoming a technical writer, and that was natural. You know, go back to those functional block diagrams, describing electronic systems. And then that led to improving those systems that I would write about. And then I would started inventing new systems in hardware and software. And, that's kind of the journey. Now I describe myself as a serial entrepreneur. And I have created a lot of inventions. And lately, the latest company is Advanced Housing Technologies. And I have been inventing sustainable electrical systems, distributed power generation systems that are used for houses, small disaster relief housing, that I invented. I didn't invent houses, but I innovated some ways that they're put together using sustainable technologies and materials and so on. And so that's the latest thing after a string of other companies that are mostly software based, because I have the background in programming, and so I like to say that my company, Advanced Housing Technologies, is really a software company masquerading as a housing company. So that's the journey.
Fascinating. I'm wondering, I also heard that you had some something in the realm of solar technology that you had invented.
Well, I didn't actually invent that. The best way to describe what I do is I'm a systems integrator. I take technologies that are existing, and then I put them together in ways that people just haven't put them together yet. That I think that comes from my creative background as a composer. I can see and hear things and put things together in combinations that other people haven't. And that's basically how it works. So recently I've been designing a very small system that's 4 feet by 8 feet that has solar panels that fold up and actually roll up, and it has an integrated wind turbine. So that's used for that'll be used for disaster relief. You go into an area that's been stricken by a disaster or catastrophe of some kind, and then you have a hybrid system that that can provide enough electricity for your basic needs, but it doesn't have to be refueled and it's completely silent. So that's the kind of thing that I do.
It strikes me.
Can it be adapted? I could do with that.
Say again, Denise.
It's like the modern version of Heathkit. I think we underestimate how much influence Heathkit had on our generation, because I used to, work with my dad as well, and it's like object-oriented programming. And I think Heathkit is sort of the metaphor for how we put things together nowadays. We get all the parts and we build new things with them.
Well, Denise, you're right. It was the 1960s versions of makers, of the maker movement. We used to separate resistors and diodes and capacitors and so on for my father, these discrete components. He showed us how to read resistor values and showed us how to do this stuff. So when I went to college and I was involved in the electronic music studio, it all seemed very natural. I would be with the guys pulling out the panels, and there would be my friends' resistors and capacitors, and we'd put scopes on them and test them and see how it goes. And actually, a few years later, I became the head of the electronic music studio at Santa Barbara, and was directly attributable to my background on the living room floor, helping my father solder equipment.
Interesting. So here's a question which is on a totally different level, is that, but I think very pertinent to today. Growing up in America, you had to deal with racism and stereotypes about being a person of color. And how has that impacted your career?
Oh, well, gosh, let's see. In the mid-60s, racism was quite rampant. I mean, it was prevalent. It was in our faces all the time. Not so much now. We've made a lot of progress, but it's of course it's still there. It's just sort of like smoldering, some sort of a smoldering embers. But I found that there were expectations and stereotypes from both sides of a very real color line for me. For many of the kids I was growing up with, they thought I was trying to be white, and they thought, and that was a bad thing. And many of the kids that I was with, you know, I was black, and so I didn't really, I wasn't comfortable in any of these worlds, and it was actually, you know, I grew up in the last part of the Jim Crow segregated South when we went off the Air Force bases. We were in this bubble in the Air Force bases, but yes, certainly I experienced a lot of racism as a child. And the thing was that in 1968-69, it was a pivotal year for me. That was when I was in the eighth grade. I got into the eighth grade, and I discovered Ralph Waldo Emerson. Hmm. And It was extremely important to me because I came to this realization that I am a nonconformist. There's something about me that doesn't really quite fit in any of these worlds. And I came to this quote by Emerson in his self-reliance essay. And he said, "Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather immortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must explore if it be goodness. Nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. Absolve you to yourself, and you shall have the suffrage of the world." And that flipped something, another switch. I discovered something inside of me that didn't need to be fueled by any external source. And it was the well of creativity that defined me in ways that transcended those expectations and stereotypes. And so I recognized in my own internal landscape, in my own universe, and then other people began to recognize that landscape in me as well. And so teachers taught me for free. I mean, I did not pay for any cello lessons for all the time I was learning as a student, as a kid. Teachers would just want to teach me. And my peers in all activities, whether it was, you know, doing speeches or doing music or anything, they all began to recognize and respect my abilities, and they didn't see the color of my skin, because I certainly didn't. And so I really sort of embodied what Martin Luther King Jr. was saying at that time, that people should be judged by the content of their character. And really, for me, it was a matter of being freed by Emerson's words to be my own authority and to not be hindered and to absolve myself to myself. And so I adopted this attitude of, if you don't like me, that's your problem. I'm just going to be me. And that's when I kind of woke up to this idea of, I can't please everybody, and certainly people are baffled by what I do, and they're upset sometimes. But I can't be black, I can't be white, I just have to be Clovis. And that was when things started getting a lot easier for me. And how it impacted my career, sometimes. In funny ways and not very funny ways, especially in technology, and I think Denise, you can bear this out. There are real and very surprising barriers even now. There are biases mm-hmm. against minorities and women in technology.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times. This is not a knock on Apple, but. You know, I used to go into Apple to do consulting, and I dare say you go into Apple right now, you're not going to see very many minorities there, not African Americans, very few. And when it comes to engineering and development and that sort of things, minorities and women are in Silicon Valley are really underrepresented. And so the way it impacted my career. It was kind of strange. You know, there were situations where I would be demonstrating software that I created, and people would look at me and they would say, did you do this? Like, what? What do you think? You know?
Or they might turn to your colleague, right? They'll turn to your colleague and ask the question.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it happens so many times. And you know, the thing is, like, they weren't thinking. I mean, if and it's really true, if I was a white man and I was demonstrating my software, they wouldn't even ask that question. And even after I had started my consulting business, Technology Media Enterprises, you know, we were up and running and doing some amazing things. I was able to hire other people on. But as for a while, I registered my company as a minority-owned firm, and we were working with Lockheed at the time. And then other companies got to know about our company and our capabilities. They would actually call me and say, oh, you're a minority-owned firm. Could you do some work for us? And I'd say, absolutely, yes. What do you need us to do? And they'd say, oh, you don't really understand. We don't want you to do the work. We actually will do that work, but we need to use your company as a minority-owned firm. And I would always say, yeah. Now, I mean, this is absolutely true. So, you know, how has racism impacted my career? You know, like I said, sometimes it's been a mixed bag, and certain things I've learned to adapt. And one thing that's kind of funny is I discovered early on that what I would do, even though I was the CEO of the company and the sort of the brains behind things, I found that it was always, sometimes, not always, but sometimes easier to have one of my fellow engineers or someone working for me actually do the negotiations and interact with the client, depending on what that client was like. It's been very interesting.
I actually am quite shocked. I thought in the technology industry, of all industries, that it would be better that way. So this is very interesting to me.
I always felt it was a boys' club, but it turns out it's a white boys' club.
Yeah.
That's not entirely true. I think there's some real genius in the folks that have immigrated here to do the program in some areas, but I do feel very strongly that African Americans and Latinos are underrepresented in technology, for sure.
So I have a question. What advice would you give to others about dealing with racism and other injustices and yet still being able to be happy in everyday life? Because there's no doubt that, I mean, things are continuing. There's some very shocking racism still. And yet it doesn't really serve us to be unhappy all the time about all these inequalities. So how do you deal with it?
You can't be unhappy about these things. I mean, I personally just can't. I mean, look, happiness, certainly my happiness, but I would say happiness comes from within. And you have to get to know your internal landscape, you know, that I talked about earlier. What makes you unique and feel good about your place in the universe? And if you don't know this, then you have to invest the time necessary to find out. Because there are very few things that are as important as that. Everything else is just distraction. In fact, I am certain that if we all know that we all know this, that we all know that happiness comes from within and we have to know our internal landscape. We know it deep down. But most of us are in denial about it, or we choose to ignore it. You know, the thing that I found is that people will respect you when you respect yourself. They're naturally drawn to another person because we all have stories. And the stories are irresistible and compelling. You know, stories are universal. You know, you have the underdog who triumphs over adversity, the seeker of truth, the defender of innocence, and the less fortunate. And you know, notice that what I just said, these are positive stories that accentuate positive values. So you don't go around saying, you know, my father beat me, life is terrible, racism sucks, I've been deprived all my life. You know, all these things serve to reinforce stereotypes about your race or your socioeconomic background. And more importantly, they keep you psychically enslaved. So, you know, like I said, people are attracted to other people who are genuine and with whom, you know, these best traits they can identify. So what Lincoln called our better, what he's called the better angels of our nature. So the answer to your question about being happy in everyday life is really quite simple. You seek happiness and it will find you. And along the way, you'll discover its traveling companions, compassion, self-love, respect, kindness, humility, caring, commitment, excellence, and even, dare I say, inner joy. So when you do this, you'll find things like racism and injustice in your personal life literally drops away. And I firmly believe that you have to free yourself before you can free other people. So when you recognize these things like racism and injustice as the phantoms that they really are, then other people who encounter you will cease to see them. They just don't exist. I know it sounds kind of strange, esoteric, but that's how it's worked in my life.
So interesting. So further on that, and this is what really struck me when I heard you say this, is that you told a group of people who, you know, we were at a mastermind retreat together, and you told us that your days range from happy to ecstatic. And when I first heard that, I found that extraordinary. And so you've told us some about how you deal with the happiness from within, but how do you deal also with the big issues, you know, how that impacts or doesn't impact in life, but how do you deal with the little irritations or the not so little irritations of just everyday life or loss and still remain in that state of happy to ecstatic?
I thought you were going to ask me that question because we had talked, Katie, about that at the meeting, and I've given some more thought to that, and I think basically, you know, first of all, and this is going to sound strange, but I rarely do anything I don't want to do. My work is my play, and my play is my work. And I strongly believe if you can't say that, then you're not living your life to its maximum potential. And the second thing is I trust so strongly in this flow of creativity, I think of the flow of life, that I actually wait until the flow is right before I do anything. And it's very difficult, you know, for people like my wife, for example, who is very, very action-oriented. Some kind of funny stories about when we first met each other. She did lists, and I didn't do lists. or rather, I would do lists, and she would get down to the end of her list before she did anything else. And I might decide, well, I don't want to do the list today. One time I was describing this thing about trusting the flow, trusting flow, which is kind of a nebulous term, but I put it this way. I was talking with a niece a little while ago, and I said, you know, there are two kinds of people. There are rowers and there are surfers, and we are surfers, my niece and I. And I said, you know, people who are rowers get in a rowboat and they row to shore. And they need to do that. That's how they work. They row, and that's how they get from one place to another. But we wait for the wave. You know, and we surf into the beach. And that's a good way to describe it. I wait for that surf and always trust in the creative surge to come and take me where I need to be. So I've gotten very, very good at doing things like that, and that brings me into a state of happiness all the time. Because like the other thing I don't do is I know it sounds strange, but I never worry about anything. I just don't. And because worrying is so destructive. And my philosophy is that if you're thinking about something that you'd be, you know, as you call worrying, and you can't do anything about it at that moment, like you can't pick up the phone, you can't talk to anyone, or you can't write that memo or whatever, I let it out of my mind. I just literally let it go. And
Clovis, it's like worrying is a waste of imagination, right? It's a use of imagination that isn't going to produce anything.
Oh yeah, I think that's one of the keys to it, to being happy. Because you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Sorry.
Have you never worried? Because having come from a mother who worried incessantly, I picked up the habit of worry, and it's not been an easy one to let go of. So were you just naturally just like that, or did you have ways to just really kind of cast that out of your life that you've developed?
Well, I can't say there haven't been times in my life when I've worried, but you just described it correctly. I think it's a habit. And like many habits, you find that you don't really need it. Denise, you're absolutely right. Especially when you're worrying, it's a block of creativity. It's something that, you know, when you examine it, first you have to know it. You say, oh, I'm worrying, and then you can deal with it. And like I said, my philosophy is, you know, if I can't do anything about it, I let it go. I think, Katie, I've always been that way. I didn't worry that much about things, but I think part of that came from this sense that if I'm in flow and I'm moving in the strong direction of flow, then there's nothing to worry about. I mean, you know, things will take care of themselves. But you know, there's one other thing that you're talking about that I want to touch on about being happy, being from happy to ecstatic. The kind of the last thing is that I think you have to be in right relationship with others, and that means you find people and places and organizations that resonate with your internal truth. I just talked about Carol, my wife. My marriage to Carol, for example, is harmonious and rich, and it's beautiful, and so there's this peace in our life, and so she's the right person for me, and so the sort of spiritual practices that I'm involved with, they resonate for me, and I know, you know, there are other spiritual practices, but I don't, if they don't resonate with me, and they don't resonate with that truth in me, then I am respectful about it, but it's like, no, that doesn't work for me. So being in right relations with everything, every person that you're with, you know, I find that some people are emotional vampires, and other people are time sucks, and other people are very, there are things that just don't resonate with me, and I don't spend a lot of time and energy involved in that, and that makes me very happy.
It seems like what you're saying underneath all of this is that you're making a choice on a day-to-day basis, maybe even a minute-by-minute basis, to choose to feed, to choose to trust, first of all, but also to choose to feed your creative flow, to put all the conditions in place where that flow can happen, and to, you must have developed the ability to say no, and the ability to make that choice on a constant basis in order to be in a condition of happiness.
Well, you know, Denise, I kind of think of it this way. You know, imagine you have a meter, and the meter is zero is abject unhappiness, and the top part of the 10 is pure bliss, right? And so right in the middle is happiness. And then you go from happiness towards pure bliss. You've got ecstasy and so on. But I think that, I know for myself, I have developed a very strong attraction towards happiness. And it sounds, for some people it sounds terrible. It's like, oh, well, that's selfish. It's like, no. If I am a happy person and I am and really genuinely happy, I think it rubs off on other people. And I think that freeing yourself is one of those things. Again, like I said, you can free other people when you're happy. I mean, when you're free, when you're happy, it's a habit. You just like naturally attracted to those things that you love to do. Like I said earlier, I love my work, and I work is play and play is work. So I just don't do things that aren't making me feel that way. I don't know exactly any other way to describe it.
The way you have described it is beautiful. It seems to me, too, you have so many talents, and you must be constantly juggling different projects that you have in mind, and that, you know, as your creativity bubbles, you're going off in different directions. What are the ways, or the most powerful ways, that you keep focused and bring some of your projects to completion?
I have to say, people ask me that all the time, and my answer is counterintuitive, and it's disturbing to some people. And this is what I say: do many things well, enjoy what you do, and be the master of many things. You know, you have the saying that, you know, master of many. What was it? Jack of all trades, master of none. I completely reject that. I don't worry about deadlines. Instead, I do this thing it's the best way to describe it is I celebrate convergence of these projects. Because in my mind and in my way, cross-pollination is really essential. For example, I profit from my downtime, and this is really true. Like if I have downtime and I'm not making money in for some consulting or whatever, you know, I will not worry about that. I will then take up something that I've always wanted to learn about. Like, you know, I'll learn about some 3D modeling program or something like that. And it's always true. If I'm relaxed about what I'm doing, not worrying about that, I learn about something I really want to do, and the next thing I know, my next job is about how do you do this 3D modeling, the thing that I just learned, right? So I would synthesize this philosophy in a really counterintuitive way. And first of all, I indulge many passions. And you will find discipline. And it'll guide you through any project because you will approach that project with a well-developed process that's cultivated from creativity. And I don't worry about outcomes. You know, again, I said I'm a surfer. The process and how it makes you feel are more important to me than anything else. You'll make the deadline. You always do. So what you do is you cultivate your creativity and you trust it completely. And that's ultimately what people pay you for, right? I mean, you know, other thing is that it's kind of strange, but you can't create from untruth, because untruth will block your creativity. So that means that you have to be truthful in your life, in your relations. When I was young, I thought that my talents and gifts would be taken away from me by God or the universe or whatever if I wasn't a good steward, if I wasn't truthful. I don't have that feeling anymore, but that feeling of creating from truth and resonance is still there. And then the last thing is that you have to share your creative, those fruits of your creative process. you have to share the products of your work, and you can't be afraid of criticism. And you don't self-edit to the point of artistic constipation. So it, for a long time, I had a problem where, you know, I thought, well, I'm a composer, and nobody's going to recognize or appreciate my music, so I might as well leave it in a drawer. And a good friend of mine showed me the error of that way a long time ago. And she said, you know, if you're not sharing your music and your talents, then you are short-circuiting the universe, and you are you're doing a disservice to yourself and to other people. So, that's how I juggle these projects, and I bring them to completion because I have complete trust that it will happen.
Well, it also strikes me that for many of us, many people, we might be a surfer, but we're playing the role of somebody in a rowboat, and we're not happy because we're not doing what we're meant to be doing. We're not aligning with that creative flow. We're not allowing it to emerge. We're putting ourselves under artificial deadlines and artificial pressures that block the creative flow. And so we're trying to be good at doing the rowboat, but we're meant to be surfing. And you know, so I think we put ourselves. I think we chose that. The world didn't choose that for us. We did that to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
And also for some of us, it might almost, I mean, for me, there's a part of me which has kind of this work ethic, like you surf rather than row, you know, which is hard work and effort. And so it's almost like I've been trained to go for the hard work and effort and not trust the surfing. So I think it's a very interesting idea I want to play with because... yeah, it's so much less stress if you're a surfer.
Well, what I'm loving about this conversation is it's really counterintuitive to a lot of what we've heard. And Clavice, I know a lot of change makers. A lot of people want to make a difference in the world. And they often sacrifice their own creativity and well-being in order to make a difference. What's your take on that?
Strong disagreement. A very strong disagreement with that statement. It goes against every fiber of my being. And in fact, I think it flies against the very nature of our very nature as human beings. Because creativity is the well from which all life springs. And if you deny that or render it secondary, that's what's wrong with our Western culture, I think. You know, because creativity on an individual level is the spark that ignites change. It's what we mean when we say that change is disruptive, you know, because people see something different and they act on that belief. If they see it, they have vision, they act on that belief, and they're the people who change the world. And true change makers understand this on the level of their DNA. And so it goes to what I was saying earlier about freeing yourself. You have to cultivate your creativity and your own power before you can change the world. I mean, it just the world isn't changed by committee. It's changed by change makers. It's changed by people who have a vision and trust in that vision.
And are doing it in some way, you know, the most changes happen through people who are doing the work out of a deep sense of joy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because others are attracted to those kinds of movements. You know, they're not necessarily attracted to the movements that are fueled on anger alone, although anger and righteous anger and passion has its place, but it doesn't sustain a movement. It's the deeper work, creativity and joy that does.
That's a beautiful way of saying that. I absolutely agree with that.
Mm. Wow. Well, we promised 45 minutes of conversation and then some Q&A, and I think we would like our listeners to know how they can access your music and learn more about you and your work. Maybe we'll say that. before we remind people how to open up or how to raise their hand?
Yeah, it's very simple. You can listen to my music. This last summer I made it completely available. It's for free. You can download MP3 files and scores and parts. You could just go to jazzicalmusic.com, J-A-Z-Z-I-C-A-L music, all one word, jazzicalmusic.com. And there's, you know, over 120 pieces, like symphonies and ensembles and jazz and all kinds of genres. And then for the technical work and inventions and that sort of thing, you can go to tmeconsult.com. tmeconsult.com.
Wonderful. And I'd like to remind those on the phone that if you would like to ask a question, just raise star or press star 2 to raise your hand. And if you're on the webcast, there is a Q&A form available on the conference call site. So if you have any questions for Clovis, feel free to raise your hand by pressing star 2 or submitting the form. I'm seeing everybody's still on the call, but nobody's asking any questions. But I do have a question personally, and that is,
yeah.
Clovis, can you talk a little bit more about trust? Because it seems like at the base of what you're doing is this trust in the flow. And do you have any? Have you always trusted, or do you have practices that you engage in that help you to open to that?
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting question. Maybe the best way to approach that is to describe flow. For me, flow is, it's like prayer. I describe my own process, for example, for composing. I'll tell you how this works for me. Composing is pure joy. It's like dancing with God. And you make decisions as a composer in the moment, and you are completely given to the process. So much so that you don't even think about the notes. I don't think about the notes that I'm putting down on paper. It's as if there's this blur. And my mind understands that this is a Neapolitan 6th chord followed by a subdominant 7th. You know, there's a part of me that's sort of analyzing what's there after a while. But, I mean, in the moment, I compose and I am completely given to that. It's like driving down the road and not thinking about what that blade of grass looked like. I'm just going. And and then, you know, I use my mind to kind of filter, you know, okay, this is the direction I'm going in. But flow is such a powerful force in my own life that it's the way that I do everything. And so to trust it is second nature. I mean, I developed this over time.
It's like developing a habit again.
Yeah. Yes. And it's because it demonstrated to me so many times that it was the right way for me to work. That you know, I know it's completely counterintuitive and it doesn't work for other people, but that trust is such a part of the process of flow for me. I think that's the way to describe it. It's actually, Denise, it's the way I do everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I can attest to that.
So I think actually a lot of artists may know that flow in their work. I mean, I certainly experience it a great deal when I'm immersed in a creative or artistic project. Where you are doing something that's very interesting too is being able to apply it to everything and to be in every part of your life in that way. And so, yeah, I find that very, very exciting and very interesting. And did you, like, so is there anything specific that encourage, are you constantly kind of just checking in, am I feeling in flow, or is there, or maybe it's so automatic now that it's hard to describe, but how did you, when perhaps, has there been a time in life where you weren't in flow and that you learned to get in flow?
Oh, yeah. I was married for 3 years and then all of a sudden I wasn't. that was a real shock to me. You know, just for all kinds of reasons. My first wife left, and it was just changes that she went through after 3 years, and she realized that she couldn't be married anymore. That was a real shock to me, and that was a time that really did test this whole concept of flow. And you recall earlier I talked about downtime. in between bouts of crying, I studied. I learned. I started at that time in 1990. The Dead Sea Scrolls were being translated by the Huntington Library, and the Nag Hammadi Scrolls had just been published. And I found I was my whole life was turned upside down. So I took that opportunity to figure out what it is that I'm all about. It's like a bowl that got turned completely upside down and everything fell out, and I had the chance to, the beautiful chance and opportunity to pick up what it was that I really wanted in my bowl, write it, and put those things back in. So during that downtime, I did a lot of studying. I really dived deep into my own psyche and figured out what it was I was about and what made me work and what doesn't. And I did a lot of programming and creative work, and I found that was more than solace. It was getting in touch with this spring of creativity, and coming to the conclusion, the realization that's sort of, if you will, my religion. And so that I started writing books and came to understand that's my that's how I do things. That's how I move and work.
We do have a caller with a hand raised, and I will open the line in a moment. But I just want to comment on Clovis, the language that you use to describe an obviously painful time in your life. But you used the phrase, "I had the opportunity to, empty and decide what I wanted in the bowl." And it strikes me that one of the things that many of us do when we've had tragedy, rather than frame it like that, we keep going back to the pain and reliving it over and over again. We don't look at it and say, "Well, that's really an opportunity." I have not always used that kind of language, and I realize that may be a pretty important thing to do, is to reframe that challenge into an opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I just even the nature of your language, I was just noticing that. So there is a caller for a cell phone in Lakeport. It looks like Loretta, actually, and I'm going to unmute the line. You have a question?
Yeah, Clovis, I think you've answered this in a couple of ways, but it's still kind of, I would like a little more. It has to do with what you, I think I heard you say, I only do what I want to do. Is that what I heard?
Yes.
I love that. My question has to do with is that inner, like inner or outer or both? Right now, I'm sitting. For example, I'm at Lake Works here in Lake Point, womaning the storm, and I'm doing it because I really believe in what it's about, and I believe in the person who helped get it started, and it's something I do on Wednesdays recently, and I enjoy it. Now, that feels more outer than inner. Would there be something else I would rather be doing? Possibly. I'm not too sure if the question's clear, but is the motivation the inner sense of this is really what I want to do? Or are there also outer, a sense of outer response to an outer need or an outer... Does that make sense?
It does make sense, Loretta. And here's how I think I would answer that. The statement that I've made that I only do what I want to do, it's obviously I sometimes have to clean the bathroom and, you know, I have to do chores. That's one of the ways I keep a harmonious marriage. But in general, I always ask myself about this inner and outer sort of joy. And my feeling is that if I do something out of obligation, that's bad. And for me, it's this balance. And so I want to move towards flow and the a joyful flow. And I find that if I am doing something that I don't like doing and it becomes a kind of a chronic thing in my life, I will do whatever it takes to relieve myself of that.
That's powerful stuff.
Yeah, I like the way you say I'll do whatever it takes to relieve myself of that, because a lot of us will look at what we don't like and maybe complain about it and talk about it and blah, 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 but we won't do whatever it takes to relieve ourselves of it, and I think that's really key.
Yeah, Well, you know what it is? It basically, Clovis, on a regular basis, you're choosing your true mission. You're choosing yourself. You're choosing that you're going to honor that creativity and that creative flow. And sometimes whatever it takes is going to have consequences, but you'll do it because that's your primary mission, is to open up that door to, you know, trusting the flow. And I realize personally that, you know, sometimes it takes a great deal of courage to do whatever it takes.
Well, you know, I have to just, I have to agree with that. I think that when we honor our own creativity, then we honor all of our creativity. It's our mission. It is for me, there's nothing more important. You know, if I'm happy, the people around me are going to be happy because they're around me. I live a creative life. I live a life that's filled with creativity, and I encourage other people to do that. So to also explore that creativity in themselves, and it's just a natural thing. I think that's really ultimately our mission, is to experience this love and joy and happiness in our lives in all the ways that it can be experienced. So I mean, I don't see why I don't see a good reason for not doing that.
Well, we've reached the top of the hour, and I don't see any other hands raised at this point. And I'm looking at the Q&A, and I don't see any submitted questions. So are there any last thoughts, Katie or Clovis?
I'll
let you do it first.
Well, I was just going to say, I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this. I very rarely have an opportunity to really talk about these things that are quite deep and sort of internal processes. So I appreciate your asking me to come on.
Well, we've enjoyed having you. Thank you.
Thank you, Clovis. And I'm just absolutely delighted with this conversation we've had. It's been so deep and profound, and I think is so important in terms of, like, even in terms of the mission of the Creativity Cafe, which is to encourage creativity, but you're giving it another level, which is just how it's so key to our joy and happiness, and it needs to be the way we go in the world. And anyway, this is just, I want to listen to this recording again and again to remind myself of these things. So,
yeah,
thank you.
Maybe, like I said, but the disclaimer here, it's just my way. Not everyone will resonate with this, but it is my way, and it's what I offer, and I thank you for allowing me.
Thanks.
And
so
I think a lot of us. I think what you've also emphasized, along with it being your way, is that it is the thing about resonating, and you do things that resonate, and even if it's your way, I think there's some lessons from it that about people finding what they really resonate with and just following it and having the courage to say no to things that really don't resonate with them or don't feed them. So I just, if there's, so thank you, and I'd like to thank our audience for being here, and check out Clovis's offerings at www.jazzicalmusic.com, and then actually, Clovis, can you just give me your other website right now?
Oh, yeah, the other one is TME, Tom Mary Edward Consult, TMEconsult.com.
Thank you. And for help in developing your creative passions and innovative projects for social change, you can check out my website at www.katiecurtin.com and Denise's offerings for spiritual entrepreneurs at www.entrepreneursandthenewstory.com. So once again, thank you very much, and we look forward to continuing the conversation in the upcoming months with other Creativity Cafe events.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.